Good morning, everybody. It's good to see you. Good morning and go Vols. We're going all the way. I won't hear anything else. Hey, we're going to be in Isaiah 9. You just read it with Charlie a little bit. We're going to go a little bit deeper into that same passage. It's going to be very helpful for us as we start our walk through Advent. Today is the first of 4 weeks looking at Advent. Hey, listen, if you didn't grow up in the church, you don't know what that word means. I mean, I made it through several years of being in the church world before I even knew what that word meant. I thought it was just some Christian Latin term or something that meant Christmas or had something to do with Christmas. But it actually means arrival. It's just a fancy way of saying arrival. And our gospel story has two of them. Two Advents, not one. The first Advent is where God pierces human history in the person of Christ. It's the Advent we're so excited to celebrate every year, complete with a manger, wise men, things like that. The second arrival, the second Advent, is where Jesus re-arrives. I guess you could say it that way, on the back of a white horse, it says in Revelation 19, to reform the cosmos. It's a beautiful Advent story. It is what I usually call the end of all ends to the glory of God. In fact, in the last few years, as I preach from sermon to sermon to sermon, I've really worked hard at finishing, driving the end of every sermon towards that second Advent, because I feel like it brings us hope to just get a peek at that end of ends. And I think hope is one of those things we just don't get enough of, right? I don't think anyone is over-hoped here. Now, what's interesting about both of those Advents is they amplify each other. In fact, they only are in context whenever they are looking at the other one. Jesus in the manger anticipates the rest of the story, his life. His death is new life. It anticipates this growing, exploding kingdom, the work of his spirit through his people to do beautiful things on this great commission. It even anticipates that second Advent. Now, the second Advent looks backward, and as we see this radical incursion of Jesus, our King, on the back of a white horse, we kind of see how important the first Advent really was. We see how important the gospel is. We see how awesome and how radical everything is that we call the atonement. Today is unique because you, on the timeline of history, are straddled between two Advents. That's your place in history. We're between two, which might be interesting, but it might not be significant for you, right? Why does it matter? Why do you care that you're in between two Advents? Why do you even care about Advent? I mean, it might be interesting, but what does a manger or a white horse have to do with your career or your banged up marriage or even your mood? What does it have to do with anything? That's a question I'd like to answer, and I think Isaiah is going to do it for us. To begin to answer that question, though, I think it's maybe important to recognize one of our deepest longings is people, and that's for a complete renewal, a complete restoration. I say that because we're a people who are partially restored, not totally restored. I mean, technically, you are totally renewed and totally restored because you cannot be more beloved than you are today. You most certainly can't be more safe or safer than you are today. You can't be more chosen, more adored than you are today. That's true. But you're partially restored in that although you're a new creation, Paul says in 2 Corinthians, you're not yet glorified, which is just a fancy way of saying the version of you, body and soul, as if sin had never existed. It's this perfect version of you, a restored version to your intended state of holiness. That's what you look like, glorified for those of you who are in Jesus. But your soul, being partially restored, wants something more. You crave something more. You sense it. You laugh, right? You laugh and you laugh, but then the laughter goes away. Kind of want to get it back. You rest and you feel more vibrant, but then fatigue comes a little bit more. You get eager to do something, maybe zealous to do something, and then you just kind of get bored with it. See, we're an incomplete people whenever you really look at it. So it's easy to say that our best moments are fleeting ones. Our best moments, that's what we call mountaintop moments, right? And don't we want to just live on the mountaintop? But we always hear people say or come up with some quick saying that you just can never live on the mountaintop. You've got to go from mountaintop to valley before you get to the next mountaintop. You can't go from top to top to top. But that's the way you were created. You were created to live on the mountaintop. So it makes sense for our soul to long to be completed. I mean, you were made to have perfect, unending peace. You were created to have an unending joy, an unending laughter, unending health. But because the cosmos is systemically broken, in every way we encounter gloom and anguish and darkness. That's the world that Adam and his wife stepped into whenever they were plunged out of the garden for their disobedience. They stepped into this place of thorn and thistle and dark anguish, and that was the reality. It's the same reality you have whenever you step out of bed every morning, even this morning. It's the same world that they did. So how are you supposed to make sense of this? This way that you were intended to live and what you really experience. How do we make sense of this? I think that's where Advent's going to be helpful. I think it's going to explain everything, really. And so I want to look at two big ideas. One is how hopelessness ends. Just how it comes and ends. And then I want to look at the confidence we have in it and then how it changes us. And we're just going to go in that order. It's very easy. Because hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before the first Advent, before Jesus came to be with you and me, there was a bunch of melancholy and gloom in God's people. That's the setting that we have. In fact, right before the passage that Charlie read, and what frames the passage that we're going to go through today is Isaiah 8:22. So if you're open to Isaiah 9, you just have to look backwards like three or four verses and you're there. Isaiah 8:22. And what this will do is it will build the frame that holds the beautiful work of art that is Isaiah 9. It says this, "And they," meaning God's people, "will look to the earth, but behold, distress, darkness, gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into thick darkness." Who's he talking about? Judah, God's people, right? They're about to be carried off into exile for a disobedient life of chasing after their own idols and being addicted to anything but God. And Isaiah is the mailman. He's the one that's coming to herald this, to declare what God is going to do. And the bully that is going to be the tool in God's hand for this is Assyria. Now, hearing this, rather than trusting in the Lord, rather than repenting, rather than coming anew to God, what they do is they go to the bully and basically give the bully their lunch money, hoping that he won't punch them. And it just didn't go so well. They are carried off. It goes miserable for them. And what is the result? Distress, gloom, anguish, thick darkness. You know, it's interesting to me about this passage, about Isaiah as a whole book, is this was prophesied 700 years before the first Advent. Think about that. 700 years. That's one of those numbers. It's so large, we can't even see it, right? Think about it. I mean, 700 years ago, I looked to see what was invented 700 years ago. Eyeglasses. And I bet they didn't look cool like they do today. I bet they were real weird and dorky looking and didn't even really work all that well. But I mean, the first one was 700. Gunpowder, 700 years ago. It's almost three times the age of our country. I can't get my mind around how long of a span of time there was between Isaiah's words and the coming of Christ. It's such a long time. Man, this just gives me so much perspective on how committed God is to his timeline. I love how it says in Peter that he is not slow to keep his promises. Not like you and I think about slowness, right? I mean, man, when I'm ordering stuff on Amazon and it says 5 days, I'm like, are you kidding me? Are they walking here 5 days? 5 days to get this thing from all the way across the world? That's ridiculous. How long is this red light going to be? How many minutes am I going to sit here? You know, I mean, if I have to wait a month for something, a year for something, I could come unbend. I could bend a little bit, right? We're talking 700 years. But for your God, one day is like 1,000 years. He's committed to his plan. He's committed to his purpose. He's not bending. I love this. I find it fascinating to me. Now, Isaiah, in 8:22, he's speaking into dark times that are very obviously going to get darker. That's why the words are what they are. Distress, gloom, anguish, thick darkness. This is humanity's fundamental condition. It was humanity's fundamental condition when they came out of the garden. It's still humanity's fundamental condition. I think this is where it resonates for all of us. Because I think some of us have some Assyrians in our life, right? Tools, things that are casting a shadow on our life that make us feel a little bit hopeless. Bullies that threaten us, like cancer, depression, inflation for some of us. I want to look at the bully of hopelessness in general, because that is the mood, the firm mood of our passage in Isaiah. It's the mood that I find today. Just a lot of hopelessness. And listen, this is what hopelessness is and is not. It's not just the absence of hope. It's the firm conviction that nothing's ever going to change for you. It's actually scary than just the absence of hope. It's the thought that nothing is ever going to change. It makes you feel stuck. It's why you feel so stuck. Like a rusty bolt. Some of you have tried to wrestle free a rusty bolt, and you could try and you could try and you try. It's not going anywhere. It's not turning. And that's how some of us feel, because our marriage is dinged up. We hate our job. Our kids are a struggle. Our body is a struggle. And as hard as those things are for us, the idea that nothing is ever going to change is even worse. It's even worse. You can work on it. You can work on it. You can work on it. But hopelessness says this is just the way it's always going to be for you. Forever. It's never going to change. This is just life. You're going to need to get used to it. That's the voice of hopelessness. You know, one of the things I love most about the Bible is, yes, how living it is and how active it is as we read, but it's also how timely it is. I mean, I want you to think about this. 700 years before Jesus, which is almost 3,000 years ago from us today, we have a man of God speaking to a specific people in a specific place at a specific time for a specific reason. And yet at the same time, God's inspiration and his breathing, his imbuing the scripture is also for you today in 2024 in Knoxville, Tennessee, for your life. I love this. I mean, I just think that's super cool. Isaiah himself couldn't have even comprehended this. He couldn't have even known this. That what God was speaking to him was going to be meant also and not less, for you, for me. This is just proof that God's goal is complete restoration in you and in the universe. In you and in everywhere around you for his glory and for your good. So let's look at this passage, because I think it's going to show you and me the end of hopelessness. This is verse 2. We're going to be in Isaiah 9, verse 2. We're only going to read three or four verses. It says this: "The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil, for the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor. You have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire." What's happening here? Here's a question that I carried to this passage. I don't know about you, but why is it talking in past tense for something that won't even happen for 700 more years? Did you notice that? It's all in past tense. This is a Hebrew way of speaking that emphasizes the certainty of event happening. Okay? They speak as if it's already happened. That's just a way that they would write, a way that they would talk. It would be like me coming and saying, "Hey, when we won the national championship, right? I mean, we kind of all expected it, didn't we? I mean, we expected nothing less. We could at least say that." And then all you'd have to say to me is, "Look, we haven't even started. We barely got in the playoffs, right? I already bought my cigar, though. We're as good as there. We're as good as there. It's already won." You would sense the certainty in me, even though I'm speaking in the past tense. That's all that we see right here. Certainty. That's the key word. And what are they certain of? A joy that they're going to feel. That's for one thing, right? We see some imagery here. The harvest is plentiful. So it's not just that the harvest is giving what they expect. They show up to pull the crops from the earth, and it's over and above what they could ever expect. That's the kind of joy. The kind of joy of dividing the spoil of an enemy. You get their stuff, Merry Christmas, right? It's the same feeling of joy that when all the mechanisms and tools of oppression are broken off, the rods, the staffs, the different things that made them feel oppressed, even the enemy's clothing and boots will be burned up. This is what we see. The idea of cosmic recovery is both certain and it's total. It's gonna happen, and it's comprehensively gonna happen. If I was one of the listeners back then, my first question is, I'm in the shadow of Assyria. How is this gonna happen? They're crushing everything they touch. They're looking at us next. How is this going to happen? Let's look at verse 6. For to us a child is born, and to us a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Let's stop just for a second. It's an important passage. It's a super classic Advent passage, right? Listen, 9 out of 9 times you're going to hear this preach, it's going to be in the month of December. Okay? No one preaches this passage, really, unless it's in an Advent, which is fine. It's fine. But these revolutionary titles, they're actually painting a picture of Jesus for you, right? So what do we see? Wonderful Counselor. That's Christ being ultimate wisdom. He was wisdom personified. You cannot get wiser than Christ. That's what it's saying. Mighty God. That's a power that you and I have never really seen before. We see powerful things. We see powerful people. But this is an otherworldly power. Here's a unique one, Everlasting Father. Let me remind you, this is talking about Jesus, not God the Father. Seems like a weird description to give Jesus, right? Everlasting Father. What is he trying to get across? It's this that relationship that Christ has with you and me is caring and is protective, like a good father's would be. That's what we have to see. Prince of Peace. Jesus is our holistic calm, it was what the Hebrews would call shalom. It's not just peace, it's more than peace. It's definitely not less than peace, but he is our holistic calm, our peace. Here's what's noteworthy about this passage. It says this, to you Jesus is given. To you. Did you read that? It says, for to us a child is born, to us a son is given. Let me just say this statement. God is all in on you. God is all in on you. This passage is in the Old Testament, but it's not less for you than it was for them. We read the Old Testament like this sometimes, and it might be a mistake. I think sometimes we read passages in the Old Testament in a way like we would maybe eavesdrop on somebody else getting financial advice by somebody super smart. We'd kind of like listen in, knowing that the advice is given to somebody else with a totally different financial situation than what you have, but it's such good advice that maybe you can kind of benefit from it a little bit. That's how we read the Old Testament. It was really just for them, but if I could just grab a breadcrumb or two off of it, then maybe I'll be okay, like 30%. It's not like that. Jesus is not less for you than he is for the world. He's not less for you than the person next to you. To you, Jesus is given. Here's another noteworthy piece of this short passage, and that is that it says two things that look like they're the same thing, and they're not. One, it says a child is born. That shows us the manhood of Christ, how he is fully man. But then it says a son is given, which is a tip of the hat to the deity of Christ. He is also fully God. Child, son. This is what scholars, pastors, nerds, this is what we call the hypostatic union. The hypostatic union, three of you just fell asleep as that came off my tongue, and I get it. You don't have to memorize that. But it is just the description of the great mystery of how Jesus could not be 50-50. He wasn't half God, half man. He was totally committed to that. He was 100% deity and 100% man at the same time. How does that work, Luke? I don't know. It's a mystery. But his fullness in both man and God is what allows him to bridge this unbreachable gap on the cross. It's because he is full man that he could sympathize for you, and his sacrifice on the cross is actually meaningful, right? But it is his full God nature that he is able to take the wrath of God for immeasurable sin as an uncontainable sacrifice. It's as if he's on the cross with one hand touching the Father and one hand touching mankind. It's brilliant. It's thoughtful. It reflects God's glory. We could never write this stuff. We could never think of this stuff. And it was prophesied 700 years before the first advent. It's fascinating. You know what I carry out of this passage? God's response to our gloom and our melancholy, it's his incarnation. His response to your bully is not a bigger bully. It's not even a religion. It's a child. It's a child. And for seven centuries, God's people would hold this scripture, wanting to believe that it was really true, waiting for it, wanting, hungering for total restoration, waiting for this fantastic son who would carry a better government on his shoulders. And as it says in Proverbs, a hope deferred can make the heart sick, right? All the listeners of Isaiah would never see Jesus. Their kids wouldn't either. Nor their great, 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 great grandkids. So why should you have hope? Why should you have hope? What reason should you have to hold on to hope when the gloom will not lift? This is where I'd like to look at the end and then the confidence we have in Jesus. It says this in verse 7. So we're moving forward one more verse. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. Hear this now. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. The zeal. God's plan will be accomplished by God's zeal. That's actually the word that this whole passage turns on, right? Because it means invested commitment. It doesn't mean what we mean whenever we say zeal. We mean sentiment. Maybe a little bit of a vibrancy whenever we say it. We think of our own zeal whenever we read this, but our zeal leaks, doesn't it? We get enthusiastic about something, and then we get real bored with it. I was thinking about this last night. I remember, it took a while to dig back into the hard drive and remember this, but I remember in middle school that my biggest ambition in life, I was super zealous, was to be a professional breakdancer. Mark's not alone. I wanted to be, so if you walked out into my garage, you'd see cardboard laid out on there because my whole goal in life was to spin on my neck so good that I could feed my family by it because I wanted to be a professional, right? And my poor parents probably watched it and thought, what is he doing? It's not like that's ever going to be an Olympic sport someday, you know? I ran out of steam. Even more recently, I remember how zealous I was. I got this crazy hair, and I've tried it 3 years in a row, and I've not been able to pull it off, but a New Year's resolution was to only take cold showers. You heard me right. Take cold showers. Why? Couldn't tell you. I just felt like it would make me a better version of myself. I would be a better human being if I could just be Viking about how I took my showers, and I could barely make it to February, and then I'd realize, hey, hot showers are better, right? I like getting into them better. I like coming out of them better. This is stupid. Nobody cares. I'm going back to hot showers. Here's the thing. My zeal hits a few walls and I quit. God not like that. God's not, it doesn't operate that way. The Hebrew word used here carries this profound idea of the meaning of zeal that goes beyond enthusiasm. It's more of an inflamed passion that's focused on one thing. A bulletproof devotion focused at one point, an unbendable commitment on one thing. This means that God is going to overcome every obstacle, even our own resistance. This is the primary reason we have for hope in the midst of our thick gloom. He says that restoration has come as if it's already happened. He says nothing is going to stop him. Let me say this again. He is all in on you. He's all in. This is how this changes us. Your current gloom, your current anguish, does not define the rest of your narrative. Right? In fact, where you feel most stuck, where you feel most melancholy, that is what will experience the most zeal and change from the Lord. Think about this for a moment. Whatever is furthest from being renewed, either in this world or the next, will experience the greatest renewal. I mean, the ugliest part of your life, whether in this life or the next, the ugliest part of your life will experience the greatest change. And he is committed to this. I find this unbelievable. And here's what's more unbelievable than that. The news gets better because this does not happen by your effort. Go back and read Isaiah 9. There is not one word, not one whiff of a word on what you and I are supposed to do. It's all about him. It's all about him. We're not being called to wear ourselves out. We're not being called to step up our game. Not being called to make 1,000 vows in 1,000 different ways. And that's how we enter church. That's how we enter this Sunday morning is, what am I supposed to change? How am I supposed to improve? Where are my improvements? Luke, give me a list. Where are my top 5 things that I need to walk out on and put some sweat to? That's what the church is for. It's what it tells me to do. There's not one breath of that here. The entire beauty of the gospel is that the load and the burden falls on a very kind Jesus. Well, then what do we do in the face of that? We enjoy him. We fall at the feet of Christ and we simply enjoy him. Hear me now. It's in your fascination and in your joy as you enjoy Jesus. That's where repentance comes from. That's where change comes from. It comes from a place of joy, not reaching for a place of joy. Listen, I'm not going to send you out the door with a big list of things to do. I want to encourage you to enjoy Christ and maintain hope. Maintain hope. Trust that God's zeal, his otherworldly zeal, is simply not going to falter. Trust that things can change for you. Hear me. In 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 1 month, things can change for you. Things can change for you. You don't have to be hopeless. Because God is committed. He's committed not to just changing you, but changing the cosmos. He's committed. What does this mean? It means that when we have brokenness in our life, we can see it through the lens of God's unswerving commitment to us. It means that this restoration project that is partial in our life, it means it's happening even sometimes when you can't see it. And it is hard to see in your own life, isn't it? It's hard to see sometimes. This means that you can trust that the pain in your life is not wasted, but it's part of this larger redemptive story. That's what a more muscular hope looks like. It's the ability to be very honest with the gloomy situation that you're in and the bullies that are around you, to be honest and not lose view of what God is doing, not to lose view of where he's drawing us, of that he is not going to miss his promises. That's what it looks like. I want you to see how committed he is to a complete restoration, not just some minor changes here or there. It's important that you see that. This is the gospel is not a story of slight little tiny improvements, but a drastic incursion, the first advent, and then a total overhaul in the second. He's looking to utterly remake reality. So it's not a story, the gospel. It's not a story of God coming close as we get cleaner. We get a little bit cleaner and God goes, all right, I'll come a little closer to you, but not real close because I don't want to get burned, you know. So I'll get a little close, but I mean, you'll probably blow it again and drop it again. And then we get a little cleaner and he goes, all right, I'll come a little closer. And because he's come a little closer to us, we go, well, then I'll get a little cleaner, I guess, since you've come a little. It's not some negotiation. I mean, he has come so close to us when we were found at our very worst. Our very worst. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Will do this. We only need to hold on to hope. Which means we need to resist hopelessness. Which is a spiritual cancer, isn't it? Hopelessness is a culprit to a million wounds. Man, some of us today, we simply believe we cannot change. Tomorrow will be as yesterday. Next year will be as last year. Maybe some small improvements here or there. But I can't really change. Friends, that's false. Or the gospel is not good news. That's false. Or the gospel is not real. hopelessness convinces you and me to say the word through our life. What's the use? What's the use? What's the use of diving into the Bible often to search for the face of God? What's the use? What's the use of this thing called community so I could be deeply known at a vulnerable level? What's the use of that? What's the use of anything? What's the use of bearing my soul? What's the use of emptying myself? What's the use of telling anyone about this beautiful news that is Christ? What's the use? It's just not going to change anything. The conclusion that we come to is that that bolt's always going to be rusty. It'll never break free. Always be levels of gloom and melancholy. But a more muscular hope begins by seeing what you're in, but knowing that we cannot be defeated by it. That's what the text essentially says. This text essentially says the darkness is real, but it's not ultimate. The darkness is real, but it's not final. Here in just a minute, we're going to take communion, but before we get there, I want to read one passage, just a peek at the last advent in Isaiah 65. Same mailman, same people. It's important to know that. And God says this. He says, "For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind." I don't know what that really means. I don't think we can know that on this side of eternity, but I can't wait to find out. Right? It says, "But be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy, and her people to be a gladness. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. No more shall be heard in it the sound of weeping and the cry of distress." Man, I can't wait for this new kingdom of sanity and shalom. I can't wait for this happiness that will forever succeed. I say it all the time, how every moment will be better than the moment beforehand. I mean, listen, we have moments of happiness today. We do. Good things, but the good things in our world can get old, can't they? My wife made something the other day. I don't even know what it is. I just know it's pumpkin cheesecake something. That's it. It's in a little bowl. I took a couple bites and I thought, yo, I'm going to hide the rest of it because my kids will eat it all because they're brats. I got one kid that will drive across town just to take it all back to her home. So I've got to hide it because I have to have as much as possible because this is all for me and I don't want anyone to know about it. I take the third bite. It doesn't get any worse. It's so much good. Seventh bite, it might actually be getting better. Listen, after my 30th bite, I thought, well, I might need to slow down. This isn't going to work out. If I had gone another 60 bites, I'd have been like, this is horrible. I can't touch it anymore. Because that's how we are with good things, right? That's not how it's going to be in heaven. That's not how it's going to be after the second advent. Good things won't get old. Laughter won't get tiring. Not only that, think about the discovery aspect. You discover new things today, and it's exciting, isn't it? Your curiosity is met. It's satiated because of a new discovery. You say to yourself, I didn't know that. That's pretty awesome, right? Do you realize that with Christ, it will be new discoveries perpetually? That means it will never get boring. You will never be bored. You will never be bored. I don't know how that works. I don't know how he does this. But I know it's true. Because the increase of his government and peace, it goes forever, he says. And when we read this, it's not merely political. We read government, we think political, but this is comprehensive renewal of all systems, economic systems, computing systems, everything. Listen, go ahead and stand with me. We're going to get ready for communion as our team comes up and leads us. And so, listen, if you have children and kids community and you want them to be a part of this moment with you and your family, feel free. We've created a little bit of a threshold for you to go back and get them. If you want to leave your kids back there and just take it by yourself or with your wife or what, then that's totally fine too. They're going to take great care of your kids back there. If you're here alone and you want to take communion with someone around you, this is a great time to clump together, right? Communion is best done in clumps. It just is. So if you're there with your community group, great time to do it. Your bestie, great to do it. If you do it on your own, that's fine too, no judgment. But this is a beautiful moment for us to do something in community. It's also something we do every week as a church. right? We tackle the table together. This is important to us because it brings logo to the word. It's like an icon, a symbol. So it doesn't mean that it's magical, but it is highly spiritual for us because we have bread and we have juice, and you can find them on those back tables. But they're very symbolic in the fact that it allows us to remember the work of God on the cross, and it allows us to look forward to what? The second advent. Our time around a table with the best bread that never gets old, the best wine that never gets old, with the best laughter that never gets old. And it remembers what will happen. And so when we take this, it's a reflection on both of those, because again, we straddle both advents. And so we're going to take this together in just a moment. But let me just finish with this before I pray for you and before the team leads you. And when the team leads you, you'll have 3 minutes or so just to take your time. Have communion there. And we'll put some prompts up on the screen for you if you just need to know how to do this, or maybe it's kind of new for you as a Christian. But listen, the zeal of the Lord guarantees your transformation. It's not dependent on your effort, but on God's passionate, unstoppable commitment to you. That's why I get so excited about it. This is gospel hope. Not that we might improve, but that God will absolutely restore. Amen.